Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 3, delivered on January 20, 2016. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and the Federal Reserve.
Today, interest rates and the Federal Reserve. Now, there are two parts to this, but they are intimately related. And I make this a special topic for two reasons. One is, much of the information that I'm going to cover here is actually in the book, but it's scattered. And I need you to have it focused in a way that this textbook does not do. Another issue, interestingly enough, is when I look at textbooks for what's going to be good, I notice trends over time, over 34 years of teaching. Something that has happened in recent years in finance textbooks in general, but also in other business textbooks too, is a de-emphasis on the role of the Central Bank of the United States, kind of taking it off the table as a major factor in business decision making. That is actually ideologically motivated. Not so much, well, there's a political side to it, but there's an ideological side that sort of is setting aside the Fed, saying, well, markets work on their own. We don't really look at the government except as this marginal agent that kind of interferes sometimes, helps sometimes. But the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, is a major, major force in business decision making, because the Federal Reserve has control over interest rates. And interest rates drive business decision making like almost nothing else you could imagine. Well, let's try something here. Sir, I want you to talk to me here for a minute. I'd like to borrow $100 from you today, and I'm going to give you $100 back in a year. What the hell? I'm good for the money. I mean, I'm a reputable person. I've got a faculty sticker. I mean, you know, I can even break the speed limit a little bit, and the police don't stop me right away. Of course, when they do, they find all kinds of things that they say, WTF. And anyway, look, concentrate. What's the problem?
It doesn't really benefit me to loan you $100.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, for God's sake, I'm your professor.
If you give me an A in the class, maybe.
No. Woman, $100 you lend me today, I'll give you $100 back in a year. Sound like a deal?
With interest, maybe.
Oh, wait, what's this interest thing?
So I can benefit?
Well, haven't you read, you know, I love you, you love me, we're a happy family, you know, and all that kind of stuff, kumbaya, hold hands. You want a benefit. Well, actually, no, you don't want a benefit. That's not exactly what's going on. So how much do you want back in a year? You lend me $100 today. How much do you want back?
How much are you willing to give?
capitalist dog. How much do you want back in a year?
20%.
Oh, no, don't give me a percentage. I want an amount of money.
$20.
$20? You give me $100, I give you $20.
$120.
$120? Are you out of your mind? What the hell? 20% interest?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, there is an opportunity cost. He's going to give up $100. You could use that right now. You could use that $100 to buy a cheeseburger. You could use that $100 to buy, well, hell, you could buy a friend for once. but the point is that it's not really so much a benefit as it is simply that you are giving up consumption for a period of time, and there has got to be a reward. At the base of all interest rates, and when I say interest rate, there are many interest rates. You know as well as I do, there's not one interest rate. But at the heart of all interest rates, there is this substrate, this fundamental rock reward for foregone consumption. We call this the real interest rate. It's the real one. It's actually hidden from our view. It gets combined with other things, but this is remember, interest rates are actually just a rental rate, rental rates. An interest rate is just a rental rate and on money. And at the heart, at the bottom of every rental rate for money is this pure reward for giving up consumption. The real interest rate is the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. That's all it is. And it's usually in an annualized form. We always, almost always, we express interest rates, whether they're 3 months or 20 year or whatever. We always express them on an annualized basis. And there are formulas. It's not that hard to do it, but really it's kind of easy. But anyway, so I'm talking like annualized. This isn't a big number. As a general rule, it's not a large number at all. And it is affected by the supply of and demand for money. Hence, where the Federal Reserve has one of its two levers is because the Federal Reserve controls the supply of money in the market. The demand for money is a little more nuanced. It's sort of like, If times are bad, you will probably put more money in your pocket. If times are good, you would probably keep less money in your pocket. If you were confident about banks, you'd let the banks hold your money. But if banks were on, you were reading news, banks were on the verge of collapse, you'd probably stuff your pockets and your mattress with money. So the demand for money is actually, interestingly enough, kind of out of the hands of everyone in the government, except to the extent that the government can create the conditions by which we have confidence. But supply and demand drive this case of real. But like I said, it's hidden. We don't see this one directly. We can actually, there's some econometric models, we can tease it out. But we always, if we're going to see something close to it, it's always combined with another little piece. And together, these two constitute what we call the first interest rate that we could actually sort of see. It's called the risk-free rate. This is actually a hugely important rate in finance. But anyway, there's this other piece that's always tied to. In the real world, we would never see the real interest rate just floating there on its own. It's always blended with this other piece. Okay, the deal is this. I have decided to hire you as an employee, full-time, 40 hours a week. And, you know, I'm a generous employer. I'm going to pay you $100 a week. Yeah, real. $80. No, $100. Okay, fine. $100. Well, you work for a year for me, and you come in here for your annual review at the end of a year, and I say, well, you've been a damn fine employee. I mean, just unbelievably good. Well, listen, inflation ran 2% this last year, according to the government, so I'm going to give you a 2% raise. There's your damn raise. Now get back to work. Okay, so you got a 2% raise. Well, the next year, you come in, and you're still doing a great job. And I see interest rate inflation has been running at 4% for the last year. So I'm going to give you a 4% raise. Okay, well, get back to work. Well, the next year, the inflation rate, I notice I do your review. Well, inflation was running 6% this last year, so I'm going to give you a 6% raise. There's your raise. Now get back to work. There are two things, well, there are three things wrong. I'm not giving you any merit increase, obviously, but that's because, really, you know, you suck as an employee. But There's two other things wrong with what I have done here. The first is that whenever the inflation rate ran 2%, and then I gave you a 2% raise. Do you see how I just screwed you out of that money? Because you had already suffered the 2%, and then I give you 2%. That's a great deal for me. Because I can guarantee you my prices were going up matching the inflation as I saw it on the shelves as a seller. But there's something else going on too. Because, okay, understand that inflation ran 2% over the year. So, all year he was making $100. But the inflation was driving prices up through the year. So I give him 2% at the end. He has lost to the inflation because he was paying as the inflation was occurring, but I compensated him after the inflation had happened. And that's one of the things that you should notice about the way a lot of employers do things with cost of living adjustments. They look at what the inflation rate was, not what it will be. In finance, we can't do that. But there's another thing going on too. 2% and then I give you 2%. 4% and then I give you 4%. 6% and then I give you 6%. Do you notice that inflation is moving upward? What would you really have wanted for the next year instead of 6%? Estimate. 2, 4, 6. 8. Good. He's good. He's good. Yeah. You see, in finance and in anything that we do in business, we do not care about what happened. We care about what we expect to happen. So in other words, every interest rate in the world starts with this substrate risk-free rate that has the reward for foregone consumption plus an expected inflation premium, which we designate as pi with a superscript e. And that's expected inflation. And this is where I have to return you to the first week of class. You remember back when we were, that first week, back when we were young and we were still happy. You remember what was the most, one of those important costs in finance that we don't see in accounting? Do you remember? Bingo, exactly. Actually, interestingly enough, there's another piece to this story too. Opportunity cost is huge. It's hidden cost. But there's something else going on. Now I'm going to move it over to you here, sir, because you were going to Illinois State University, you were working on your degree, and you were doing just fine, and then one night you were sleeping, and you had this dream of something else that you wanted to do. And you woke up and you realized, I can't be here. I've got to do what I wanted. I want to be the manager of a little tiny gas station on the south side of Toledo. One of those ones with a little kiosk and they sell cigarettes in the front and then there's this little room in the back where there's a black and white TV. Well, that's, you wanted that. That's your dream. So you change your name to Earl so you can wear a shirt that has an oval that says Earl. You buy a pair of pants that when you bend over your crack shows, and then you go and you start this gas station. Okay, well, you see, these independents, there are other independents all along the road there, and the prices tend to always, you reflect each other price. That's not collusion, that's perfect competition. You can sell as much gas as you have at the prevailing price. Nothing big about that. Well, the Cocaline truck comes up to your station and is going to sell you 10,000 gallons at $1.40 a gallon. Okay. And you're out there and you're talking with him, waving to him. And after he finishes up, you mark up your gas 20 cents to $1.60. Well, Cocaline driver's heading down the road to the next station. You go back in. You go back to your sad little kiosk. So you're going to keep watching. You were watching Rachel Ray. And you sit back down and you're wondering what the heck is going on. That's not Rachel on the TV. This is some news bulletin. So you turn every channel, and it's on every channel, these extraordinary news bulletins. And so you say, well, what the hell is going on? And you're seeing images of battleships burning in the ocean, it looks like. Then you see pictures of fighter jets bombing something. And then you see a mushroom cloud coming up. And you finally start looking at the ticker. It says here, oh my God, somebody attacked Iran, laid waste with nuclear weapons to their nuclear facilities, and then they responded by firing silkworms and sunburned missiles through the Gulf of Hormuz. They've already brought down one United States aircraft carrier, two battleships. The United States has called an emergency meeting of NATO. Meanwhile, reports of Mark IV missiles coming out of Iran that can reach Vienna, and one has already struck, missed by a little bit. Explosions. There's these aircraft carriers in the Gulf. The Strait of Hormuz has been mined, and already two super tankers have hit mines, and they are on ablaze and spilling their oil. So by the time that Coquelin driver gets to the next gas station, he's charging $10 a gallon for the gas he's selling to your competitors. So you're looking down the road as their signs are changed. Their signs are all going to $10.40, all the way down the road. What are you going to do with your sign? No, don't do 30. You can sell as much as you want at 40. But wait a minute, you got it at $1.40. What the hell? Are you some kind of ripoff artist? How dare you take advantage of a terrible, terrible situation? Is he wrong?
No.
Why not?
Business?
No. What's he going to have to pay for the next load of gas?
The price everyone else is paying or more?
Replacement cost is all that matters. It's not historical cost. It's replacement cost. If he charges $1.40 a gallon, he's going to be wiped out of his gas. If he charges $10.30, he's going to be wiped out. He's got to match the competition, because if he goes below, if he still holds at $1.40, what he paid plus a markup, he's not going to have any money when the Coquelin driver comes back around. And his expectation is that Coquelin driver, the next time he comes around, he ain't going to be charging $1.40 a gallon. All that matters to us is our expected replacement cost, not what has already happened. Taking that back, and that's not evil, that's not cruel. We're out of business if we play the Good Samaritan. If we play, well, I'm not going to screw my customer love me. They'll just eat your gas up and they'll forget about your station when you're out of business. They'll just be down there bitching about the $10.40 they're paying at the other stations. They don't give a rat's ass about you. Really. So that's something that we have to understand in finance, is that when we put an expected inflation premium on interest rates, it is because we have to look at the future. A lender has to have the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Has to have that. But the lender is also going to have to charge what is expected to be the erosion of the purchasing power of that money when it comes back. That's why you will have an expected inflation premium that can get stuck in interest rates. There's a great story about this back from the 1970s. Honestly, it was really in the 60s it started. Printing money faster than the economy was growing. That's what causes inflation. There is no other cause of inflation. Companies jacking up their prices, that's not inflation. Unions getting higher wages through negotiations, that's not inflation. That does not create inflation. There's one and only one thing that creates inflation, and that is printing more money than the economy needs. So as the economy grows, the growth rate of the money supply should match that growth rate of the economy, so that the economy maintains liquidity without having excess liquidity, which ultimately will always create inflation. Well, in the 60s it started, and in the 70s it was just getting ridiculous. Printing money hand over fist. We had NAM, we had all of these social programs coming along, we had every constituency crying its heart out for this, that, or the other thing, rich and poor alike. And by the time we get down to the, and then there was an oil embargo, so the Fed printed a whole pile of money to make everyone feel good about how bad the gas prices were. By the time we got to the Ford administration, which was a two-year administration after President Nixon resigned, it was recognized we got a problem with inflation. Gerald Ford tried to do it sort of like this big, almost like a campaign thing. He had these buttons that were printed up, whip inflation now. Now, of course, that's not how you stop the inflation. You have to clamp down on the money supply. You can't put a button on. Well, Jimmy Carter came into office after Ford in early 77, and he started out with the same idea. He got up on TV and he said, "I see inflation as the moral equivalent of war." Well, unfortunately, moral equivalent of war has the acronym MEOW. But on the bright side, Carter was a highly educated man, nuclear engineer, and he was very much aware of how you stop the inflation. You have to clamp down the money supply. You have to crush it. And all along, these chairmen of the Federal Reserve had been providing accommodative monetary policy. Well, unfortunately, what that led to was inflation. And then the worst thing, expected inflation. So when Carter in 79 appointed a total, disgusting, inhuman asshole to be the Federal Reserve chairman, no one believed that it was going to change anything. His name was Paul Volcker, Tall Paul. He smoked a big cigar, and he would blow the smoke right in your face. He didn't care. Interestingly enough, he's still alive. Apparently, the devil doesn't want him down there. But Volcker, he said, "I'm going to cut the money supply." Well, supply of anything goes down, the real interest rates will go up. But no one believed that Paul was going to hold on. So expected inflation just kept skyrocketing, spiraling upward. So you had the real interest rate going, you had expected inflation still going spiraling up. So once Volcker crushed the money supply, you had mortgage loans, home mortgage loans at 22%, 25%. There were corporate bonds with coupons at 30%. Of course, the economy nearly... And essentially, Volcker just held his throat, held the throat of the economy and said, "Do you believe me?" The banker said, "Nope." "Do you believe me?" "Nope." And after about 2 years, "Do you believe me?" "Yeah." But the problem was, of course, we'd gone into a recession, so Carter lost the election in 1980. It's rather difficult to explain this to the average voter, what was going on. And he was replaced by Ronald Reagan. And by that time, it was like 82, finally, the expectation of inflation began to fall. Finally. And Volcker still held on to this very tightly for a few more years, or at least. But ultimately, once expected inflation had cooled back down, and the Fed was convinced that the bankers believed that they weren't going to do this stupid stuff again, they began to release the money supply a little bit more, let it grow a little more. And so you had the real interest rate go down, interest rates in general went down, and business activity picked back up. So it looked as if Carter had screwed up the economy, his successor had saved the economy, which to a certain extent, I can't argue that that's partly true because there were some pretty good tax cuts to help tide the economy over in the early 80s. But anyway, that gives you an idea of how fundamentally important this expectation of inflation is. It can drive the economy. And in business, it drives our business decision-making so much. Those interest rates do. Therefore, we have to appreciate that the Fed has a very strong influence on our economy, at least in the short run. And unfortunately, if the Fed screws up, that short run can become a long run. And in business, I'll tell you right now, High interest rates hurt like hell in business. They hurt for a couple of reasons, interestingly enough. But fundamentally, I mean, the cost of our borrowed capital goes up. If the cost of borrowed capital goes up, the cost of equity capital goes up. And when those go up, we don't have, our economy begins to slide. But there's a worse thing that happens too. High interest rates, remember I told you the greater the risk, the greater the expected return? Interest rates have an intimate tie to risk. When interest rates go up, when I invest in a project, I have to make more than it costs me for the project. And that includes, if I've invested a project, the return on the investment has to exceed the cost of the capital. So if the cost of the capital is going up, I have to start going for higher and higher return projects. But if I'm going for higher expected return, I have to take more risk. So in a higher interest rate environment, you see companies beginning to step up their risk profile because it's not worth it to take the low risk, lower expected return projects. So companies begin to start stepping into more dangerous territory. They go for what we used to call the Hail Marys, those long balls and things like that. And of course, then you get more bankruptcies happen. And then the economy has the high interest rates where business investment has cooled off anyway because there aren't as many projects being done. And the projects that are being done are higher risk, so you have more business failures, so it can create all kinds of excitement for the economy. However, now, this animal right here, this is the risk-free rate, R sub F. We don't see it exactly, but there is a security that is what we use as sort of an approximation of it, very close to it. It's the yield on a very short-term treasury bill. The yield on a short-term treasury bill. So if I look at a three-month T-bill, annualize its return. That's a pretty good, because it is risk-free. I mean, seriously, the government is not going to default on its debts. You know why the government won't default on its debts? Because it can always just, if it needs to borrow money, if it needs to pay you off, it can borrow more money to pay you off. If that doesn't work, it can just raise taxes to pay you off. And usually, I mean, if nothing else works, well, we'll just attack another country on false premises and take their assets, and then we'll pay you off. It's a win-win for everybody. But that's the rock bottom. That's like the substrate, the first interest rate we would actually see. Now, all other interest rates are on top of this one. And they are different because of what is called the risk premium structure. There are three pieces to the risk premium. There are three pieces to it. And normal interest rates have some combination of these three. Some ones big and others are small. Let me start with the first one. I keep writing R's. The modern uses K for interest rates. I apologize. K sub D. This is the default premium. This is the reward for bearing the risk that part or all of the cash flow won't be paid off, paid back. The reward for bearing the risk that part or all of the cash flow won't be paid back. In some instruments, the default premium is very low. In other instruments, it is very, very big. Try a couple. Madam, a home mortgage loan, 30-year fixed rate, would that have a high default premium or a small default premium? Believe it or not, actually it has a very low default premium. Mainly, first reason is because it's an asset-backed loan. So that if I, as a homeowner, default, the bank gets an asset. Right, and they can sell that off. The second reason, which is sort of a secret, is that banks make you, as the borrower, pay an insurance premium so that if you do default, that insurance pays the difference between what they sell the house for and what was owed by you. Most people have no idea that they have an they're paying in their monthly payments. There's an insurance premium. So when banks cry crocodile tears, we lost so much money because of all these banks. Bullshit, they lost nothing. Because they got the asset back, and they also got the insurance company, MGIC, Magic, the Mortgage Guarantee Insurance Company, to pay back the difference if they didn't sell the house for what you owed on it. Interestingly enough, that you are required to pay that premium if the loan-to-value ratio of the house is above 80%. Most people have no idea that it's there, and all through the loan, they're paying an insurance premium. They don't have to. I ran into a couple. They were close. They had a loan-to-value ratio. They didn't been paying on their mortgage for years. It was around 30%. They were still paying this mortgage insurance. They didn't have to. I said, you go to the bank, you tell them to stop it. Well, they did, and they were given this bluff, and so I called for them on their behalf. Really? No, by the law, you can't charge that to them. They have told you to stop it. You stop it right now. But, okay, there's virtually no default premium because it's like there's an asset back. Let's try another one. A car loan. What would you say? High default premium or low default premium?
I would say high.
It's actually intermediate because, again, it's asset backed, right? If you don't pay the loan payments, they'll take the car back. So they get the car back. But there's a problem there because, as the old rule goes, when the car goes off the lot, it usually loses maybe $1,500 of its value right there. So there is a risk of a gap in there. So there is a default premium. It's not a huge one, but it is there because there is a potential exposure. Besides, you have to hire those repo guys who wear those ninja outfits, and they charge you a lot for being ninjas. Okay, let's try another one. Credit card debt, high or low default premium? Very high. High as a kite. High as a 60s rocker. Yes, it is a very high default premium because, I mean, there's no asset backing. And if you're like me, you see your credit card bill, and that's one of those things that you sort of fill up the trash can with. No, I don't do that. Student loan, high or low default premium, what would you say? It's actually low because the government will come. They will find you. If you stop paying on it, they will send a wet team and rappelling for black helicopters to seize your assets. Okay? They will get their money back. Yeah. Guaranteed loans are usually that way. Okay, now the next one is a little trickier. This is called the maturity premium. Seriously? Okay. The maturity premium. This one's a little harder to get your hands around because this is a double downside for the lender. You, sir, you have graduated from Illinois State and you have decided that you are going to buy your first home. It's about 5 years out. It's time for you to buy your first home on a 30-year fixed mortgage. Interest rate you get for the loan is 8%. Okay, now I'm the lender and I lend you 8% and I expect to get an 8% return on my investment on you for 30 years. Suppose in about 5 years later, interest rates fall on mortgage, home mortgages, to 5%. What are you going to do? Anything? You're paying 8%. Current mortgage rates are 5%. I wouldn't. What would you do?
Try to get that 5%.
Refi. You'd refi. That's all you do. You just refinance the loan at 5%. Everybody does it when interest rates fall. So I, the banker, get screwed because what has happened is I was expecting 8% for 30 years. 5 years out, interest rates fall. So I end up getting that money back and having to lend it back out to him at 5%. So I am bothered by the fact that interest rates in the future might go down because I will then not get my 8% anymore. So there's a risk there, but it is on the other side. You, sir, have bought a house. Now, I'll bet you didn't know it, but the average homeowner holds first house for about 7 years, and then you move on. Well, it's you borrowed money at 8%, and you got married, and it turned out that you were fertile of loin, and you have 3 kids, and another one on the way. Well, actually, there's 2 more on the way, but your wife doesn't know about that other one. Okay, so you're just, obviously, you're living in a house that's not going to accommodate all these kids, okay? But suddenly, interest rates on home mortgages go up to 18%. Are you going to do the usual thing at 7 years and just sell this house and buy a new one? Oh, hell no, you'll park those kids in the basement. I mean, you know, it's fine down there. Here's some Cheetos. Play World of Warcraft, kids. Yeah, you see, what's going to happen is that I'm a banker. I'm saying, I need money for 18. I can get people at 18%. Don't you want to sell that house? And you're going to say, well, kiss my ass. No, I'm going to keep it. I'm getting 8% from you. I would really love to have you pay that loan off so I can lend that money back out at 18%. But you're not stupid. You're not going to do it. So I am hit on the upside. If interest rates go up, I, as the lender, am doggy drilled. I should not have. The point here being that the interest rates that are happening here are volatile. So this maturity premium is the reward for the risk that interest rates will change over the life of the investment. Because if interest rates go down, people are going to refi. If interest rates go up, people are going to hold on when they should have sold the daggone house. So in other words, this maturity premium is related to volatility expectations. If I am an investor, I am worried about volatility. If I think that interest rates are going to be smooth, there's not going to be a wild turbulence up or down or up and down, then I probably am not going to have a high maturity premium. But if I'm worried the interest rates looking out are going to have a nasty volatility to them, well, I'm going to be a little concerned about that. And finally, there is the liquidity premium. Now, the book, I think, calls it the illiquidity premium. But it works like this. A lot of investors don't hold on to an investment for the entire life of it. A bank, for example, you borrow money for a home from a bank, that bank sells that loan. Within literally, in some cases, within minutes, it's gone. It's packaged up with other loans and it's sold to these giant super pools that blend all the money, all the loans together into these super bonds. Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae are the secondary mortgage markets. So, I mean, these mortgage loans are highly liquid. The banks dump them quickly. Other kinds of loans, student loans, are highly liquid. A bunch of students go in to get their student loans for the year, for the semester or the year, while the banks make the loans, and then they just ball those up and sell them into a secondary market called Sallie Mae. And other types of investments are that way too. However, some investments you can't dump, even if you want to. Look, if I buy a treasury bill, I can sell it within seconds. I buy a corporate bond, I can sell it within seconds, call my broker. If I'm a bank and I lend money, that's investing in a security, I can get rid of it very quickly. But there are some that are not that liquid. So for example, like if I personal loans, if a bank or a credit union makes a personal loan, It's probably going to have a hard time unloading that if it wants to get that money back for something else. So there would be more of a liquidity premium or illiquidity premium. When I was years and years ago, I ran a penny stock house. And the one thing, understand, I talk about debt, but equity has interest rates just like debt has. And people would want me to sell their stock, and these were penny stocks on the pink sheets or just barely alive on the NASDAQ, and I couldn't do it right away. I'd have to find some sucker who would buy the stock, match the order. So I had this lady call in. She said, I need to sell my 10,000 shares of this company that I was making market for. And I said, well, I can't sell it right away. I'm going to have to see if I can find a matching order for a buy to match your sell. Because I'm sure not going to take this on my own. And she just had a cow. I mean, and that's I just said to her, look, cow, I can't do anything about it. I'll look around and I'll put it out there on the electronic bulletin board service, but I can't tell you when I can do this. So that was why the prices were so low, was because there was this illiquidity premium risk. You can't unload the instrument that quickly. So that takes us to the next thing, to the next part. Oh, by the way, interestingly enough, just to make sure you understand, this is every interest rate has a risk structure. The interest rates are different. It's because these components are different. For example, a government bond, a long-term government bond, would have no default premium, it would have no liquidity premium, but it would carry the maturity premium in it, interestingly enough. And that's where I will show you the first thing that I have here for you, for your dinner. This is called a yield curve. All it does is show yields of government debt. So the only risk premium in there would be the maturity premium, which represents expectations of future volatility. So what I'm looking at here on this stockcharts.com, they have a dynamic yield curve. This would say, all right, here's the yield on a very short term, these are annualized yields, on a very short term treasury instrument. Still very low, a little higher than they were. The Fed's finally starting to clamp down on the money supply. And it's got this upward arch that's actually fairly healthy. It might be arching a little bit strongly up in this area, but that's a fairly healthy yield curve. Notice as time goes on, there is more risk of interest rate volatility. Maturity premium is going off. In other words, that difference between the right there at the beginning and anywhere out here would be the effect of the compounding of the maturity premium, mostly. Now, interestingly enough, I'm giving you here a chance to see what might be the future, because you want this curve to have an arch. It's just regular, normal compounding of a maturity premium for longer and longer treasury instruments. Nothing big about that. If it arches too much, that tends to mean that there's probably an expectation of inflation that's out here that's bigger than what's back here. If it's too flat, that worries a lot of economists, because, I mean, a yield curve that's going downward is a really bad, you want to be on the other side of the universe from a downward sloping yield curve, trust me. But there's one thing that can happen with a yield curve that's very interesting. If there's a yield intermediate that's higher than an interest rate that's a little longer, in other words, if you ever see this pattern right here, that's called an inverted yield curve. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. Now, there have been inverted yield curves that didn't lead to recessions, but the other side, every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. And now, the personal story about this. Back in the first part of the 2000s, I was writing an economic weblog where I was talking about economics, I was sort of like giving a popular explanation of economic concepts, finance concepts, talking about politics and social and education things. And I became focused in about 2006 on the American economy. There were some really scary things that I was seeing in the numbers. One is that business investment had collapsed. In about, from it was in 2002 to 2006, it was half of what it had been in the 1990s. Debt levels were going up for individuals. The budget deficits, which had been completely conquered, we were running budget surpluses, were skyrocketing again. And I was writing, we've got a problem here. And it's a lot deeper than you might think. But interestingly enough, the thing that I was looking for was the inverted yield curve. And it just would not invert. I kept watching it and watching it. And I was writing these articles. I wrote two major series saying something is very bad, but it might not happen. And then one morning in 2008 in the spring, there was a technical inversion. The 10-year was yield was just slightly below the 7-year, and then the 20-year was above again. That was a technical inversion. I said, "That's it. We're going to have a major, major, major financial crisis," because the other numbers had pointed to it anyway. And of course, I was called a conspiracy theorist and all that. I wrote that article in May of 2008. And I called it the Gospel of Impending Doom. We're going to have something really bad happen. Okay, now let's reel forward to September 15th. This is a longer part of the story here. And I'll show you more about it here in a little bit. If I don't do it today, I'll do it on Monday. What am I thinking? Okay. When the banks on the East Coast started opening on the morning of the September 15th, 2008, something strange was going on. It wasn't notable right away, but the Federal Reserve Bank on the big Federal Reserve Bank on the East Coast, the New York Federal District Bank, the Empire Bank, as it's called, they were watching. They were seeing something troubling. There were vast withdrawals of funds from money markets in the banks on the East Coast. Where they were going, we didn't know. Now, usually, if money is going out of one thing, we would see it going somewhere else. And how would we see it? Well, if that money were going into gold, gold prices would be skyrocketing as the money was put in. We didn't see commodities prices going up, nothing. Just large sums of money from the money market accounts on the East Coast just being sucked out. It was getting very serious by 9:30, and by 10 o'clock, $550 billion had been drained from the money market accounts on the banks on the East Coast. It was already the banks in the Midwest and mountains were starting to open, and it was happening there too. It was banks where, as the sun came up, the banks were just being bled. At 10 o'clock, an emergency meeting of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors determined that they would have to close down the money markets. No further withdrawals would happen. Essentially, like a bank run, they were stopping a bank run by closing the banks, making a bank holiday. It was so severe that Congress was called into emergency session. As it was told later, the doors were locked, and one rabble-rousing representative at the time, Jeff Sessions, said to then Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Madam Chair, are we under martial law in this chamber? She didn't answer. She walked away from the podium. The Treasury Secretary at the time, Henry Paulson, the Federal Reserve Chairman at the time, Ben Bernanke, and representatives from the White House all came to the session and they said there was nearly a financial apocalypse. If that had been allowed to go on any further than what had already happened, every bank, as the sun came up, would have eventually buckled, probably within hours, across the world. the banking system would have collapsed. That happened on September 15th, 2008. It was nearly the end of the financial aspect of our civilization. Your ATMs wouldn't have worked. Your paychecks that were in the bank wouldn't have been any good. It would have been essentially every man for himself, and all the maniacs and idiots in the world would have come out of their woodwork and made the world back in the Dark Ages. It would have been that. And hardly anyone knows that that happened. They smoothed it over. They just shoveled money hand over fist into the economy. They controlled where the banks were able to allow withdrawals from money markets. Go. That's a very good question. The answer is, oh, obviously, no. We would have expected some commodity or security to have started spiking in price as the money was put into that commodity. Nothing. Nothing. It wasn't there. It just wasn't. Where the hell did that money go? Oh, we don't know. Or at least we say we don't. But, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. It really was only one gunman at Jack Kennedy's assassination. Anyway, go ahead.
That day I remembered, I was in eighth grade. What exactly was it that it was like that day, like that everyone decided to call? What was it?
It was obviously a coordinated plan, whatever it was. It was not, there are extraordinarily wealthy interests. But one person or one family or one trust doing that? No, this had been in the works for some time that this was going to be done. Who? Why? Well, the why is actually kind of known. I'm going to show you something here. I showed this in an article. I said, this is freaky. This is not fun, what I'm seeing here. And this came from an article that I wrote. I collected some of this data myself. Now, interestingly enough, if you were to look at the data from the Federal Reserve now, it would not show this. I collected this data through the 2000s. These are the money supplies, M0, M1, M2, and M3. Probably won't get to it today. I'll extend that quiz for a while so I can talk about this next week a little bit. But the thing is, you see, M1 is just money, cash, currency, and demand deposits at banks. It's everyday money, the you money, the me money, the business money, what we do use to transact. That's M1. It should follow the growth rate of the economy. M2 is M1 with big time deposits in it. And a few other things, like credit union checking accounts are actually an M2 because there's a little less liquidity to them. But there's big CDs in here. M3 is all of M1 and the extra stuff in M2. But it also contains the euro dollars and the massive multi-$100 million certificates of deposit. The Fed stopped reporting M3, saying no one uses it. So I had to gather the data with some people from the shadow government statistics to rebuild it. The reason they had stopped reporting it was because euro dollars were just going skyrocket. Euro dollars are the money that we have bought foreign goods with that is now in foreign banks. So because we were buying so ridiculously much from the Chinese, the People's Bank of China, Canada, Japan, Europe, Russia, there was this massive growth. Now this isn't levels, this is growth rates of money. Notice what was happening to M1. The Fed was not able to control M3. So it stopped publishing it. But what it also did was it clamped down on M1. But you see, that's the problem, is that that was the money that we need to make our economy run. That's liquidity. And our economy was growing at about 2.5% to 3%. The Fed had crushed that money supply so it wasn't growing. So, of course, the economy, I was screaming, they were going to buckle. This can't keep going on. So you add to that some sons of bitches pulling $550 billion out of the money markets. Money markets, well, guess what's going to happen? You're going to have a zombie apocalypse. And you got to do your cardio, your double tap, and all that kind of, if you know zombie. Anyway, a lot of people ask me, what was going on back here? Oh, that was just after 9/11. The Fed put a lot of money into the trucks. They literally drove trucks all over the country in case people were freaking out and they were starting to run on the banks. And then later they pulled the money back out because people didn't really freak out too much. So I'll get back to that in a minute, though. But yeah, that's just after 9/11, the Federal Reserve had this big, almost like military operation, getting money to every bank in the country if people started running their banks, whatever. But anyway, back out here. Do you see what was happening was that the Fed had essentially tried to solve the problem of all of these euro dollars, these highly illiquid dollars that the banks in the rest of the world use to reinvest in our country. They can't spend the money, American dollars, anywhere else. They were just piling up because we were buying so much. A lot of that because one country in particular was essentially pegging its currency so that its stuff was super ridiculously underpriced here. But how did the Fed solve it? Well, God, they were just crushed the money that businesses like mine use, people like you and me use. It was just, there was no growth. And you have zero growth of the money supply when the economy is growing at 3%. You do that for a couple of years, and yeah, guess what? You're going to have a liquidity crisis. Add to that, if $550 billion suddenly goes, yeah. Okay, I got one more thing I want to show you, and then I'll finish this lecture on Tuesday, so I'm going to extend that special quiz about a half a week for you. But I do want to show you something interesting. Remember I told you this was the Fed getting all that money out to the banks after 9/11? Remember I told you that? Here's September the 11th. Wait. Why was the liquidity being put into the banks starting at the end of August? September the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, and then the 11th. What do you see? What do you see? Those planes hit those buildings on September the 11th. No one, to quote our vice president at the time, no one could possibly have known that that was going to happen. But what do you see from that chart of where the money going into the banks, being printed and put into the banks? When did that start? When the planes hit the building? No. Those trucks were on the road a week before, filling the banks with the money in case people ran the banks on September the 11th. Nothing to see there, folks. That's all I have for you. I thank you.